Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
I think everything with the small farms now that are doing this is make or break, whether people realize it or not. What we're trying to do is ensure that this is something truly sustainable.
Larry Howard of Maple Valley Farm is hoping to entice shoppers to join his Meat CSA. We hear from him and four other farmers about what it takes to operate a successful community-supported agriculture program. We also meet a young immigrant from Central America who's trying to make a life in rural Kansas. It's never too early to start preserving foods. In no time, you'll have enough radishes and eggs to knock out our two recipes. And how do you take your popcorn? Simply with butter and salt? Or are you game for more adventurous flavors? Sarah Fentum has a story about one of America's favorite snack foods. Let's catch up on food news with Mark Chilla.
Well, we looked at five topics this week, Annie. Researchers in California say exposure to pesticide combinations increases health threats such as damage to DNA, hampering the body's ability to get rid of other toxins, and even increasing the risk of cancer. The report from UCLA's Sustainable Technology and Policy Program showed that contact with any two out of three common pesticide fumigants at the same time can mutate cells and prevent them from repairing themselves. Some of those chemicals are commonly used for growing strawberries, tomatoes, stone fruits, and tree nuts. The study's authors called on California's pesticide regulation body to test commonly used pesticide combinations and impose restrictions on cocktails that could damage health. The report prompted a coalition of parents, workers, and educators in California's Pajaro and Salinas valleys to demand a one-mile buffer zone between fields treated with pesticide combinations and homes and schools. Wild fish grown in captivity quickly adapt to their artificial environments with big changes to DNA, according to a new study. In a paper published in Nature Communications, researchers found that after only one generation, differences showed up in 736 genes compared to wild cousins. Crowded conditions, frequent injuries, and exposure to disease spur the fish to adapt, with changes to immunity, wound healing, and metabolism, the author said. Researchers have long suspected differences between wild fish and their domesticated counterparts. Fish born in hatcheries that are released into the wild reproduce at much lower rates. The study's authors said more study of the genetic differences could help farmers improve conditions and make farmed fish closer to species found in the wild. The number of farms and ranches in the U.S. is on the decline. And as Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon reports, the farms that remain are getting bigger.
The U.S. has lost nearly 120,000 farms since 2008, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The average farm size in the U.S. increased 5% over those years. Bill Meyer is a regional director for the USDA's statistics office.
This has been a long-term trend in agriculture that the larger farms need more land to continue to operate.
The farm landscape has been moving in this direction since World War II. Mid-sized farms get bigger, they consolidate, and the ones that don't survive close up and sell. Meyer says plummeting commodity crop and cattle prices right now could exacerbate the trend next year, and he expects even more farmers to leave the field. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
An update on a story we've been following about food labels on New York City menus. The New York State Supreme Court ruled this week that chain restaurants in the city can be fined for failing to post sodium warnings. As NPR reports, the ruling states that chains with at least 15 locations nationwide must print a salt shaker warning icon next to menu items containing 2,300 or more milligrams of sodium. That figure is the upper limit of sodium Americans should consume in one day, according to the latest dietary guidelines released in January. NPR sought out some of the most sodium-laden dishes in chain restaurants, one from Panera and another from Applebee's. You can read about that in the article on our website. And we're following the latest on the GMO food labeling debate. This week, Senator Pat Roberts was expected to force a vote on a draft bill in the Senate Agriculture Committee. Read what happened in Washington and find out how states are addressing the issue of labeling foods that contain genetically modified ingredients. That's all at eartheats.org.
and on Twitter. There's even more news. Find us at Earth Eats. Mark, thanks for the work.
You bet.
After crossing the border from Mexico, tens of thousands of unaccompanied child immigrants were resettled in the U.S. while they await immigration proceedings. While many young immigrants now live in big cities like Houston and Los Angeles, thousands were placed in rural towns. Reporting for Harvest Public Media, Esther Honig traveled to a rural community in western Kansas where she found young immigrants struggling for security.
17-year-old Diego from Joyabá, Guatemala, says he came to Liberal a little over a year ago. Living here, he feels he has more freedom.
I say that here is liberty for everyone.
He's still honing his English, but says that here it's safe to play outside. Back home, you have to worry about being robbed or even killed.
Es que en Guatemala, ya saben cómo es el lugar allá, es pobre, pues.
In Guatemala, you know, it's a poor place. There isn't money for food. We don't have a lot, and I don't have a dad.
No, yo no tengo papá.
I met Diego at his home, a small trailer where he lives with his half-brother and his family of four. Diego is not his real name, but because of his immigration status, we've been asked not to reveal his identity.
Yo vine acá porque quiero...
I came here because I want to help my mom, and since I'm her oldest son, well, I took the opportunity to come here and study and later look for a job.
A smuggler was hired to bring Diego to the United States. The journey from Guatemala through Mexico took a few weeks. Then he was apprehended by Border Patrol while crossing into the U.S. and placed into federal custody. After being held at a shelter for 1 month, the Federal Office of Refugee Resettlement released Diego to his half-brother. Over the past decade, many immigrants from Mexico and Central America have come to this region for work at meatpacking plants. Many of these unaccompanied minors were united with relatives that had previously moved here for work. That's how Diego and the other 155 young immigrants came to live in the small rural city of Liberal, Kansas.
Cuando lo vi, me puse tan feliz.
When I saw him, I was so happy. I even cried because I had never seen my brother until I saw him here.
Immigrants like Diego are designated unaccompanied alien children by the federal government and can remain in the U.S. until their scheduled appearance in immigration court. In order to avoid deportation, some may claim asylum or apply for special immigrant juvenile status, which states that they've been neglected, abused, or abandoned by their parents back home. In the meantime, he can't work legally, but he's been able to attend high school, something he could not afford to do in Guatemala. In a sunny classroom at Liberal High, Diego's ELL teacher, Lori Navarro, reviews idioms for an upcoming test.
Okay, give me the fourth one, somebody. What's the fourth one, Marvin?
There's a wall lined with photos of her students. Each one has written their story of immigration and how they came to Liberal. Navarro says these young immigrants like Diego are often pressured into working.
You think you have it bad, and then you hear everything that they've gone through, and then what they're still going through here.
Unaccompanied minors are not appointed lawyers by the government. But without a lawyer, it's really hard to sort out their legal status. And representation in these cases can cost as much as $6,000.
They have to work to provide financially because they're not living with their parents, and they also have to send money back, and then they have to pay for their attorneys.
Navarro says at least half of these students have earned money working nights under the table, mostly at the local meatpacking plant.
You get our kids who, you know, are here and come to the U.S. to better their lives and make it easier, and yet, you know, they work all night and go to school all day, and some of them probably don't even get that much sleep, and then they're back at work.
The school social worker, Sarah Carrillo, has spent the last decade working with immigrant families who come to Liberal. She says last year she got her first big group of unaccompanied minors.
The host wants them to drop out of school, get a job, start paying rent. We have kids who are couch surfing from one friend to another.
She says many are living with near strangers, and that leaves them vulnerable to neglect and even human trafficking.
Most of them are with cousins, aunts and uncles, someone from the neighboring village, anyone who will agree to go to the immigration center and sign a paper saying they're responsible for them.
That means Diego, the young immigrant from Guatemala, is under a lot of pressure.
I paid a lot to come here, and now I have debt, and I have to pay it.
Diego says he borrowed about $3,000 to hire the smuggler that delivered him from Guatemala. Now he'd like to finish his education. But he says he might have to forego that and start working instead. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Esther Honig.
Check out more stories from this reporter collective at harvestpublicmedia.org. Story ahead of the Academy Awards this weekend about popcorn. Indiana is the second most prolific popcorn producing state in the country, but the industry is in a bit of a slump. Earlier this month, the USDA reported that production was down 29% from last year. The rainy weather was to blame, without a doubt, but also there was less demand. 2013 and 2014 saw bumper crops of popcorn, so it's not that customers were moving away from this beloved snack food. It's that the market was overpopped with corn. Sarah Fentum reports that our love of popcorn is intimately connected with how we like to spend our free time.
Palmyra, Indiana is pretty much God's country. We're talking church-sponsored bridge games, American flags outside every house. Palmyra is also home to the Preferred Popcorn Company and its manager, Brian Churchill, who's taking me on a tour of its factory. We're watching some futuristic-looking popcorn robots bag up corn that's falling from a hole in the ceiling.
So it's laying it out and it's putting the corn in the bags, in the paper bags, and it's weighing out 50 pounds at a time.
It's a whole lot of corn going by very, very fast.
It looks like it's going really quickly.
About 600 bags an hour, 650-pound bags per hour.
All you math nerds out there, that's 30,000 pounds of popcorn each hour.
This is going overseas, so it has a special label in it in their language.
Once the popcorn is bagged, it gets shipped to countries all over the world. Preferred Popcorn ships to so many places, Churchill doesn't even know where this batch is going.
Gosh, I don't even know what that language is.
They go to an Arabic-speaking country.
Yeah. Looks like maybe.
If you think about it, it's kind of perfect that Preferred Popcorn is located right in the middle of the American heartland. Because even though it's never reached the iconic status awarded to, say, apple pie or cheeseburgers, it's one of the most American treats there is. Movie theaters, baseball games, county fairs, they'd all seem incomplete without popcorn. But the snack hasn't been around forever, according to Andrew F. Smith, food historian and author of books like The Rise and Fall of Tuna and Hamburger, A Global History.
It's a tough job. Somebody's got to do it.
Smith says even though popcorn has been around for thousands of years, Americans only rediscovered it during the 19th century. But it really became popular during the Great Depression, thanks to movies.
Typically, as soon as theaters started serving popcorn in the 1930s, that's when popcorn took off as a snack food. So it became extremely important during that period of time, mainly due to movie theaters.
And except for a dip right before the introduction of microwaves in the 40s and 50s, popcorn has remained super popular ever since. It's even gaining traction overseas now, in countries like China, who like it for the same reason America does. It's really cheap.
Popcorn itself is very inexpensive. By far, it is the least expensive snack food that's available today.
But just like sliders and beer, this previously humble snack has started to receive the gourmet treatment.
Honestly, I knew I wanted a business, and I really didn't know what I wanted to do until I was in Chicago. This is before I even started. I saw a line wrapped around the corner of this building. I said, "What in the world is going on up there?" It was Garrett's Popcorn, and a shock went through my body, and I knew that's what I had to do.
Inga Smith is a gourmet popcorn maker who splits her time between Indianapolis and Bloomington.
Why do I think it's popular? It's easy. It's broad. It's gluten-free.
Inga jumped on the popcorn train at just the right time. She opened her Bloomington shop 3 years ago, and it proved to be so successful, she opened a second shop outside Indianapolis only a year later. Customers pay $7 a quart for Inga's popcorn, and according to her, it's perfect for every occasion.
Birthday parties, bridal showers, weddings, and we've become pretty much a gift shop. A lot of people buy my popcorn to give as gifts.
So why are people willing to pay $7 for a little bag of popcorn?
I think it's like embedded in our growing up. I mean, it's movies, it's sporting events.
Logan Grezik was stirring up a batch of caramel corn at Inga's when I visited.
I remember, like, family cooking around the stove, like, popcorn, and you can't really, if you're in college and you're away from your family too, come get that, like, traditional popcorn thing that you can't really get anywhere else. I mean, you can get microwave popcorn, but it's just not the same as made out of a popper.
Inga's flavors are, for the most part, pretty tame. She offers caramel corn and cheddar, of course, along with jalapeno and cake batter. But people have been getting really creative. Depending on how adventurous you feel, you can try margarita popcorn or even the pregnancy mix, which is dill pickle and ice cream flavors mixed together. Back in the factory, it's easy to realize why the snack is so attractive, because it's so simple. Farmers bring the grain to the factory, a huge machine sorts it by size, and after that, the robots seal it into bags. Literally nothing has to be cooked or made. Popcorn is good to go.
The load that we were looking at, it goes to Lebanon.
Lebanon? Oh, we finally found out where it goes.
Remember all those bags from the beginning? We finally figured out where they were being shipped to, Lebanon. And no, not Lebanon, Indiana, Lebanon, Lebanon. Maybe soon people there will be enjoying dill pickle and ice cream popcorn, too. For Indiana Public Media and Earth Eats, I'm Sarah Fentum. A twist of fate makes life worthwhile. You are gold and silver. I said I wasn't gonna lose my head, but then pop goes my heart. Extra special thanks to Sarah Neil Estes for collaborating with Sarah Fentum on this story. Listen to it again and see pics at eartheats.org. Coming up, this recipe starts with a lot of salt and several days in the sun.
Then what you do is you finish it, some rice wine vinegar, some sugar, and some ginger. If you want to make them spicy, you could put some crushed red pepper flakes on there too.
Daniel Orr has a recipe for pickled radishes and then pickled eggs with Bob Atkins. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington.
Okay, you ready?
Annie Corrigan here with Chef Daniel Orr. It's Earth Eats.
I'm going to show you a recipe that my friend Mihoko taught me how to make when I was living in New York City and had a rooftop penthouse garden. So this is a sun-pickled radish. She did it with the daikon radish. Daikon is this big radish you can see here. It's almost like a baby's arm.
A muscular baby at that.
A little Arnold Schwarzenegger baby. All right. So you can use that, and that's what I traditionally use. But this year at Kolb Homestead, our farm, we're getting all these little long radishes. These are 2.5 to 3 inches long, red, really, really pretty. What you do is you take your radishes, and I put them in a plastic container. Okay, now we're going to put quite a bit of salt, okay? And we're just going to rub that salt into the radishes. This is going to help the salt permeate the radish and start drawing out the liquid. And then you're going to go put this in the sunniest part of your yard, or if you live on a rooftop like I used to, put it on the rooftop. Now, things happen outside that don't happen inside, like bird flyovers and things like that. So what I always do is put a piece of cheesecloth on top so nothing can go in there. And you leave them out there for about 10 days to 2 weeks. And what you get is, I've got some that we did. And you can see how they've shriveled up, dried up. Then what you do is you finish it. Some rice wine vinegar, some sugar, and some ginger. If you want to make them spicy, you could put some crushed red pepper flakes on there, too. And I'm going to let you try one of these little sun pickles.
Still crunchy.
These will last a long time. Now you could put them in a jar, keep them in the fridge. But I serve these chopped up fine on top of my pea soup. It'd be great to have on a sushi platter.
That day, he served them with a salmon mousseline and some steamed asparagus. Daniel is taking your recipe requests. Let us know what recipes you want to hear on Earth Eats. Write us at eartheats@gmail.com. As the days get longer, chickens will start laying more eggs. For those times when you have more eggs than you can possibly eat or give away, we've got this from Chef Bob.
I always remember my grandmother having a big jar of pickled eggs with beets, and there were these bright pink pickled eggs and the pickled beets all in there. And it's something I really enjoy, something that you used to see a lot of times, you know, in bars and old saloons and stuff like that. And they're really easy to do. The only real time it takes is to cook the eggs and to make the brine. There's really only one surefire way I've ever known to boil eggs. And boiling is a misnomer, because really you want to simmer. If you're boiling, you're agitating, you're breaking shells. So you start with 30 eggs in a pot large enough to hold them. Cover them by at least 2 to 3 inches of cold water. Put them on a high heat. You bring them up to one boil, you turn off the heat, cover them, let them sit off the heat for 10 to 15 minutes. After that, some ice water to shock the eggs. So while the eggs are coming up, you can prepare your brine. So I have 8 cups of malt vinegar. To that, I'm going to add some fresh ingredients. I've got one large Spanish onion, 2 jalapenos sliced down. The size doesn't really matter. So it's just you're lending the flavor to it. Some garlic, which is going to give it a different type of spice. We're also going to add some red crushed chili flakes, fennel seeds, about 1 tablespoon of dried oregano, some whole black peppercorns, a little fresh rosemary and thyme, a few bay leaves, one of our all-time favorites in pickling. We're going to add 1/4 cup of kosher salt all to the mix there. So we boiled and peeled the eggs, of course, or simmered the eggs. We're going to cut a little slit in a crosshatch pattern on the egg, just down to the yolk, so that it's going to allow that pickling brine to penetrate a little bit quicker. So we're going to do that to all of our eggs. I'm going to pour the hot brine directly over in just a stainless steel soup tureen. These will be ready in 2 days minimum. I would love to let them sit a week. They've got, and the longer they sit, I think the better they get.
So much better. Be patient with these. See photos of Chef Bob Atkins at eartheats.org. We still have at least a couple months before spring crops will be harvested, before summer farmers markets really start bustling, and before farmers can start collecting on the crops they've grown. But this is a busy and expensive time of year for growers. They have to buy seeds and soil amendments. They hire workers and improve their farm's infrastructure. To get an influx of cash when they need it the most, some farmers create CSAs, Community Supported Agriculture Programs. It is CSA Day at the Winter Farmers Market today. There are 5 vendors touting CSA programs. The basic facts are the same, table to table. You pay a flat fee now, and then you get food for 18 to 25 weeks or so starting in May. So the farmers talk about what they think sets their CSA apart from the competition, starting with Michael Hicks of Living Roots Eco Village.
We offer both a standard and a flexible model for people who aren't always in town. We grow pretty much every vegetable you can imagine, and we have a big you pick strawberry patch now, which will also feed into our CSA.
I specialize in heirloom varieties, European varieties, and I grow for flavor. Having chefs as customers, I have to have wonderful flavor.
We are an organic farm. We're not certified organic. We grow a lot of greens, and a lot of times we have greens throughout the really hot, dry parts of the summer. We've got special techniques to grow them that most farms kind of give up on.
And what you're doing is you're committing to focusing a good portion of your meat budget to one farm to ensure the survival of that farm, while getting the very best in terms of transparency, nutrient density, and the quality of the meat.
That was Larry Howard of Maple Valley Farm. Before him, Jim Boffman, Freedom Valley Farm, and Teresa Bertels of Heartland Family Farm. Teresa's table is packed with melons, three colors of cauliflowers, beans, broccoli, berries. She admits she bought this food from the grocery store just to illustrate the variety she offers in her CSA throughout the growing season. But it seems to be causing as much confusion as excitement.
I've had some people who they're not familiar with seasonality. So they think, oh, do I get strawberries in with my winter squash, or do I get tomatoes first thing in the spring? So the seasonality question has been a huge, huge question.
It's romantic to fantasize about fresh from the farm vegetables when you're still wearing a winter coat and scraping your car off in the mornings. But for a farmer, the CSA can be an important part of their bottom line.
It's make or break. I mean, it really is.
Larry Howard's meat CSA includes beef, lamb, goat, chicken, turkey, eggs, and pork from his farm.
I think everything with the small farms now that are doing this is make or break, whether people realize it or not. We've been in this 10 years, and so we know what the numbers are. What we're trying to do is ensure that this is something truly sustainable.
He wants to be able to pass the farm along to his kids. Howard is hoping for 50 members. He breaks down where the money goes, 40% to salaries, 40% to sourcing the animals, and the rest is for the risk management fund, the what-if money.
What I fear the most, probably, I have to be honest, is that, you know, we have a bad growing year, you know, and we don't have much to put in there. I'm not sure how well they would really accept that. And it's something that I worry about.
Jim Boffman says his farm revolves around the CSA. That really dictates how much he plants. He had 40 members last year, and he wants to nearly double that this season. And that's despite a stressful 2015 on his farm.
And last year got really bad. We had a lot of rain early on, and we had a lot of onions rotting, carrots rotting in the ground. We had the foliar disease problems. So it was a struggle, and I was at one point thinking, like, oh, we're going to have to refund people. But somehow we managed through it, and we actually were able to give them their amount every week, and we got through it.
Kathy Curry is shopping around for CSAs today.
It just sounds like a great thing to do. I've tried to raise my own garden throughout the years and not had a lot of success.
After two conversations with Hicks of Living Roots and Bertels of Heartland,
I'm ready to sign up, but I know that's not a wise thing to do. I'll think about it over the week.
She grabs flyers, takes one last look at the bounty on the Heartland Family Farm table. She still has three more pitches to hear, and then she'll go home and see how a CSA fits into her food budget. We took pictures at the market, and those are posted at eartheats.org. Our team of Earth Eaters includes Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepherd, and everyone at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Great. It's been a good day. I'm Annie Corrigan. Till next time.